Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio from Monday, April 26, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Census Bureau releasing data from the 2020 census. U.S. population now over 331 million. And the Bureau calculating six states will be gaining seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Seven states will be losing seats. The big winner, Texas, two more seats. And for the first time, California will lose a seat. Details just ahead. President Biden this week giving his first speech to a joint session of Congress and marking 100 days in office. We'll talk about it with the Hill's White House reporter, Brett Samuels. Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing a federal investigation into policing practices of Louisville, Kentucky Police Department. This comes just over a year after Breonna Taylor was shot and killed by plainclothes officers serving a no-knock warrant on her home. And the Supreme Court agreeing to hear a challenge to New York's laws on carrying a concealed weapon, the first major Second Amendment case before the Supreme Court in over a decade. Now to the U.S. Census Bureau news conference. Today's data release coming after a number of delays. Legal fights over the Trump administration's efforts to not include undocumented immigrants in the state population counts and to then add a citizenship question to the census form. And delays from the coronavirus pandemic. The Census Bureau Acting Director Ron Jarman summarizing how big the population of the U.S. has gotten in 10 years.
According to the 2020 census, the number of people living in the United States was 331,449,281. This represents an increase of 7.4% over the official population count from the 2010 census. This population growth rate is lower than the previous growth rate of 9.7% between the 2000 and 2010 censuses. In fact, the growth rate from from 2010 to 2020 is the second slowest in U.S. history. The country's 7.4% increase in population this decade was only slightly more than the 7.3% increase between 1930 and 1940. For the regions, the South grew the fastest over the last decade with a 10.2% increase in population, followed by the West with 9.2%, the Northeast with 4.1%, and the Midwest with 3.1%. The Northeast grew faster this decade than it grew between 2000 and 2010, while the other three regions grew slower this decade than the last.
The Census Bureau Acting Director Ron Jarman. He also today listed which states stand to gain or lose seats in the U.S. House of Representatives based upon the state's population compared to other states. It's the reapportionment that happens every 10 years of the 435 House seats.
Overall, the effect of the official 2020 census population counts on congressional apportionment is a shift of seven seats among 13 states, which is the smallest number of seats shifting among the states in any decade since the current method of calculating apportionment was adopted in 1941. Six states will gain seats in the House of Representatives. Texas will gain two seats, and Colorado, Florida, Montana, North Carolina, and Oregon will each gain one seat. Seven states will each lose one seat in the House: California, Illinois, Michigan, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. The number of seats for the remaining 37 states will not change.
You can find the full news conference with the Census Bureau Acting Director Ron Jarman at our website, cspan.org. With Texas gaining those two congressional seats, it'll raise the number of seats to 38. Texas has now gotten at least one additional seat after every census since 1950, and two or more seats after every census since 1980. California losing a congressional seat, it'll be down to 52, still the largest in the nation. But the first time California has lost a seat after a census since it entered the Union back in 1850. And Montana getting one more seat, now up to two, becomes the first state that was once relegated to one, to an at-large status, to now regain a second representative. Last had two in after the 1980 census going through 1992. This from CNN. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill will juggle a slate of competing priorities this week as both parties wrestle with tense negotiations over infrastructure and police reform. Deliberations will play out during a week set to be defined by President Joe Biden's first address to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday, which will serve as a kind of call to action for lawmakers to meet the moment with bipartisan solutions for the country's most pressing issues. That from CNN. On infrastructure spending, the president has proposed $2.3 trillion. Senate Republicans have given a counteroffer of about a quarter of that. Today, Senate leaders making their case on the Senate floor. First, the minority leader Mitch McConnell, Republican.
When America actually puts our mind to things, we can do them. Remember Operation Warp Speed? But this isn't like that. This is a sloppy liberal wish list that would spend a lot and get very little in return. The far left has been bragging about all the social engineering and welfare spending that is stuffed into these proposals. They boasted that the DNA of the Green New Deal is all over this administration's agenda. Roads, bridges, and ports are bipartisan priorities. Water infrastructure and broadband are bipartisan priorities. That's why when the Senate tackles honest-to-goodness infrastructure in a smart way, we almost always have wide bipartisan margins. Last week, our colleague from West Virginia, Senator Capito, got together with the other ranking members of committees that deal with actual infrastructure. These Republicans put forward a smart proposal that would meet pressing needs in actual infrastructure. So now comes the critical moment. Now's the time we learn whether Democrats really want to jumpstart actual public works projects or whether infrastructure was only ever intended as a wrapping paper for unrelated gifts to the far left. Remember what happened when Republicans went to President Biden offering a bipartisan compromise path on COVID relief. They were informed the Democrats were not interested in working together. So our country needs the administration to find a smarter approach.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell on the Senate floor. Also speaking, the Senate Majority Whip, Democrat Dick Durbin, who defended President Biden's infrastructure plan.
More than half a century ago, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower launched the Interstate Highway Program. It changed America. Today, the program's nearly 50,000 miles of expressway carry about one-fourth of all traffic in the United States. These roads connect our communities, have created communities, and serve as a bedrock for our economy. In today's numbers, if you tried to rebuild the interstate highway system, it would cost $500 billion. Probably much more, to be honest. It's not a small sum, but boy, it's an investment that paid off. The program generated $6 in economic activity for every dollar spent to build those roads and highways. And the fact is today, we need to invest in order to build our future. When President Eisenhower launched the Interstate Highway Program, we didn't have e-commerce or same-day shipments. It was more than 10 years before Neil Armstrong stepped foot on the moon. Now each of us carries around a pocket-sized device with more than enough computing power to get him to the moon and back. The world has changed many ways for the better. Today it's not sufficient for an infrastructure plan to begin and end with bridges and roads. If we want to support a modern economy and sustain growth for generations to come, we need to invest in the infrastructure of tomorrow. This isn't to say that we have all the answers on this side of the aisle, but there is one answer we should all get behind. Go big, go bold. We can't penny pinch America in the first place. And don't take it from me. Americans of all political stripes, Democrats, Independents, and Republicans, support marshaling the resources of the federal government to go big and bold on infrastructure. They want us to not only repair our highways and bridges, but to rebuild our waterways and airports and make high-speed broadband internet available to everyone. Americans support a plan that puts us on track to have an American century in the 21st century.
Senate Democratic Whip Dick Durbin on the Senate floor. That infrastructure spending proposal from the president, plus a new one that he's expected to make to fund child care and education, all that and more, the topics the president will talk about on Wednesday when he addresses the joint session of Congress for the first time in his presidency. And C-SPAN will be taking you live to Capitol Hill, beginning at 8 p.m. Eastern with a preview of the evening. The president's speech begins at 9 p.m. Eastern. That'll be followed by the Republican response given by Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina this year. And then after that, you'll get the chance to react to it all via phone and social media. All begins Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern. For more about how the president's speech is coming along, a question today to the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
Go ahead.
Looking ahead to Wednesday to the president's speech before a joint session of Congress, can you give us a sense of how the speech is coming together, the president's involvement in it, how he wants to use that speech, and his appearance there to sell the remainder of his legislative agenda?
Sure. Well, first, the president has been working over the last couple of days, as he will be over the next two, on his speech. He's deeply involved in the development of his speech. He's thinking a great deal about what message he can send directly to the American people about what progress we've been made, but, of course, what challenges remain ahead. He recognizes, as somebody who served in the Senate for 36 years, that this is an opportunity, one of the highest profile opportunities even the president has each year, to speak directly to the American people, and that's exactly what he intends to do. He will lay out the specific details of the American family's plan in that speech, but he will also talk about a range of priorities that he has for the upcoming months of his presidency, including putting in place, working with Congress to put in place police reform, including doing more to expand access to affordable health care. So there will be a range of priorities he will also mention in his speech, but he's working closely with his speechwriters on it, but also with policy advisors and policy in the policy teams on finalizing the components that will be in the speech.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki at her daily briefing in the White House briefing room. C-SPAN spoke about the speech and other items this week with The Hill's Brett Samuels. He covers the White House.
Yeah, Wednesday will be obviously, you know, everybody's been sort of waiting for weeks now for the president to make his first big speech to a joint session. And I think we'll hear him lay out his agenda, certainly for the rest of this year and perhaps for beyond. I think there'll be a couple big items that people are expecting him to discuss, one being this American Families Plan, which is sort of the next prong of his sort of big legislative proposals. We're expecting it to focus on child care, family care, education. So that'll be, you know, his next sort of big spending push, and we'll see how that's received. And then there'll be some other items, I'm sure. You know, policing reform is certainly sort of a big topic right now, and I'm sure the president will call on Congress to act on that. And we may hear some other items in a similar vein, whether it's, you know, gun laws or something along those lines. I'm sure we'll hear the president again urge Congress to act. But certainly this will be sort of President Biden's first big speech where, you know, have a big national audience, members of Congress. So it'll be his chance to sort of outline his vision moving forward for the country.
But can you give us a sense of how this is going to look? This is a recess week, district work period for the House and the Senate, and yet the White House timing this to mark 100 days for the president in office, and we have the pandemic. So what will the chamber look like Wednesday evening?
Absolutely. So, yeah, we won't see sort of the traditional, you know, packed chamber of Congress with all the members lining the rows to try and shake the president's hand as he walks by, you know, sort of the usual pomp and circumstance they were used to with a State of the Union, for example. We're expecting, from what, you know, congressional officials and White House officials have said, we're expecting about 200 members of Congress potentially to be in the building, spaced out a bit to allow for some social distancing. They won't be allowed to bring guests as they have in the past for the State of the Union. The First Lady, for example, won't bring guests for her box, as we have seen at State of the Unions and similar speeches in the past. But the First Lady, is expected to attend. So it'll be a little thinner crowd in the chamber there. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see. That'll be something to watch, you know, which lawmakers do choose to attend in person, since, as you noted, you know, a lot of them won't even be in town. So that'll certainly be something to watch, but it'll be a little lighter crowd than we've come to expect with these events.
We've been talking about some of the polls from Fox News, from the Washington Post, in terms of the president's performance on the job, getting generally favorable reviews, except on the issue of immigration. And it's something that came up yesterday on CNN's State of the Union, an interview that was pre-taped with the Vice President Kamala Harris. Let's show our audience part of that and get your comments after.
This is the work that we're doing, but it's not going to be solved overnight. It's a complex issue. Listen, if this were easy, it would have been handled years ago.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you when President Biden said, you know, would you like to do this or not? Would you like to, you will do this? Did you say, oh, gee, thanks, Mr. President?
No, he asked me to do it, just as he was asked to do it. Joe Biden, as vice president, was asked by President Obama to focus on the Northern Triangle. Mm-hmm. And he has asked me to do and to carry on the work that he did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get back to the question that you've asked. We're making progress, but it's not going to evidence itself overnight. It will not. But it will be worth it. And I will tell you, part of my approach to this is we've got to institutionalize the work and also internationalize it, which is why, for example, I'm working with Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, and we're going to be increasing the requests we're making of our allies in the United Nations. Because, again, this is about the Western Hemisphere. We are a neighbor in the Western Hemisphere, and it is also about understanding that we have the capacity to actually get in there if we are consistent. Part of the problem is that under the previous administration, they pulled out, essentially, a lot of what had been the continuum of work. And it essentially came to a standstill.
That from Vice President Kamala Harris on CNN's State of the Union. Sir Brett Samuels, what are you hearing from the vice president? And more significantly, what, if anything, will change moving ahead with the Biden's policies along the border?
Right. Yeah, certainly, you know, as you mentioned with the polling, this has sort of been one of the main issues that they've sort of struggled to, you know, find the right messaging on, find the right policy on. And it's been something Republicans have really attacked this administration and blamed them for what we've seen at the border in the first few months in office. And I think the vice president, you know, that's sort of what she's been saying. We've heard for a few weeks since she's been put in charge of the Northern Triangle region, at least, has been, you know, that this is going to take time. This won't be fixed overnight. But certainly, I think, you know, Republicans especially and sort of skeptical voters in those polls, I think, are looking for, you know, some kind of shift at the border, whether it's, you know, to be able to get the number of migrant children in government custody, to sort of get that number down, to see some sort of meaningful change in migration patterns in Central America. I think, you know, voters will be looking for some kind of meaningful shift there in the coming weeks and months to show that this administration is sort of getting it under control. Obviously, it's a big issue. This isn't the first administration to deal with it. But the vice president is meeting today with the president of Guatemala. She said she'll be meeting with the president of Mexico soon. She'll be traveling to Guatemala, I believe, in June, she said. So I think that's something we'll be seeing, you know, an increasing amount of action on it in the weeks to come from this administration.
And the president Thursday will be in Atlanta, Georgia, to do what?
Right. So he'll be marking his 100th day in office in Georgia. Obviously, it's sort of the state that has allowed him to accomplish much of what he's wanted to accomplish so far, electing those two senators in January and giving Democrats the majority in the Senate. So he'll be holding, I believe it's a drive-in rally, you know, people driving up in cars to hear him speak. So it'll be marking his first 100 days, and I'm sure looking forward to the coming months. But certainly Georgia, you know, has a lot of electoral significance for this president and for Democrats, especially moving forward. It'll be a key state.
Almost $2 trillion in the COVID relief bill, a $2.25 trillion infrastructure plan, just part of the spending that we've seen in this White House so far. The headline from thehill.com, if you can react to it, Republicans worry that fiscal conservatism is losing its rallying cry. What's going on here in Washington?
Yeah, I think, you know, Democrats are sort of making this bet that the public isn't so worried about, you know, deficits and deficit spending and, you know, these big price tags on these bills. They're more concerned with, you know, does this bill, you know, does it provide direct payments to Americans? Does it provide assistance to people who are struggling with their rent? Does it, you know, increase childcare and healthcare? So Democrats are sort of making these bets, and the president certainly among them, that, you know, they can push these big spending bills and they won't necessarily pay the price at the polls just because Americans, you know, see the price tag or wonder, you know, about deficit spending so much, that's sort of a bygone issue. So certainly it's something I think Republicans are maybe going to have to find a new angle to attack Democrats over, because that doesn't seem to resonate like it once did, I don't think.
But is there a sense that the debt matters, now approaching close to $29 trillion?
Yeah, you know, it's certainly an issue. It comes up, I think Republicans talk about it now. You know, Democrats will say it's hypocritical because they didn't seem to care when President Trump was in office. So, you know, it's something that I think people certainly are mindful of. And you know, it's sort of always, we've seen presidents, you know, sort of kick the cans, they, you know, they'll address the debt and then it sort of balloons. So it's, you know, it's an issue that it's a great question. I'm not sure if it's top of mind for a lot of voters, but I think certainly for some people, it's sort of, you know, the next generation will be the ones to pay for the debt. So I think it's sort of something that's always sort of in the back of people's minds. It's just a question of, as we're seeing, you know, how much people care about it now and what sort of the sense of urgency is to address it now.
Brett Samuels is a White House reporter with The Hill, joining C-SPAN on Monday morning's Washington Journal. On Wall Street today, the Dow is down 61, NASDAQ up 121, S&P up 7, NASDAQ and S&P setting new record highs. Biden administration expanding a program that feeds up to 34 million school children during the summer months. We'll be using funds from the coronavirus aid package that was passed last month. Families of eligible children will get about $7 per child for each weekday. Should add up to about $350 over the summer. The White House says the U.S. will begin exporting AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccines once the vaccine clears federal safety reviews, and up to 60 million doses could be exported. White House says that with the Johnson & Johnson single shot now being used again, that along with the approved double shots, Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, that's enough to supply the needs of the U.S. population. And the White House also says President Biden spoke with the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, and pledging to provide aid to that country, the world's second most populous, that's dealing with another COVID surge, 350,000 cases in one day, a new record anywhere, 2,700 deaths. Total death toll in the country is now nearing 200,000. Mentioned earlier that police reform, one of the items being negotiated this week, could be talked about by President Biden during his address to a joint session of Congress on Wednesday. For the second time in as many weeks, Attorney General Merrick Garland today announcing an investigation into policing practices of a major city with a very high-profile case of a black person killed by police. Last week it was Minneapolis, after former officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of murdering George Floyd. Today, Louisville, Kentucky, 1 year after Breonna Taylor was shot and killed when officers in plain clothes tried to serve a no-knock warrant on her home.
The United States Department of Justice is a federal law enforcement agency comprised of thousands of law enforcement officers who collaborate with and support our colleagues throughout our nation's police departments. We are uniquely aware of the challenges faced by those who serve as police officers. We see their commitment firsthand every day, and we recognize the complex issues that make their already difficult jobs even harder. The Justice Department is also charged with ensuring that the constitutional and federal statutory rights of all people are protected. As I explained last week, Congress has authorized the department to conduct pattern or practice investigations to help it fulfill that responsibility. Those investigations and the recommendations and actions that ensue do not only protect individual civil rights, they also assist police departments in developing measures to increase transparency and accountability. Those qualities are necessary to building trust between law enforcement and the communities they serve. And community trust is essential to making policing more effective and less dangerous for officers on the street. Today, the Justice Department is opening a civil investigation into the Louisville-Jefferson County Metro Government and the Louisville Metro Police Department to determine whether LMPD engages in a pattern or practice of violations of the Constitution or federal law. Today's announcement is based on an extensive review of publicly available information about LMPD conducted by the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. The investigation will assess whether LMPD engages in a pattern or practice of using unreasonable force, including with respect to people involved in peaceful, expressive activities. It will determine whether LMPD engages in unconstitutional stops, searches, and seizures, as well as whether the department unlawfully executes search warrants on private homes. It will also assess whether LMPD engages in discriminatory conduct on the basis of race or fails to provide public services that comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Attorney General Merrick Garland at the Justice Department. Also today, this from CNN, the family of a black man who was fatally shot by police in North Carolina last week was shown Monday a short snippet of police body camera footage that one family attorney described as an execution. Andrew Brown Jr., 42, fatally shot by the sheriff's deputies in Elizabeth City on Wednesday when they attempted to serve him with an arrest warrant, according to the sheriff's office, and the mayor of Elizabeth City, North Carolina, declaring a state of emergency as the city awaits the release of the full body camera footage. Back in a minute with more Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo denying he had done anything inappropriate with any of the women who have accused him of sexual misconduct and harassment. The governor speaking with reporters face-to-face for the first time in months. He was at a New York State Fairgrounds fair in Syracuse. Former Congressman Doug Collins, Republican from Georgia, says he's not going to be a candidate for any office in 2022. He lost a U.S. Senate race in 2020 to Democrat Raphael Warnock, and there have been some speculation he would challenge Warnock again, or maybe even in the primary, Republican Governor Brian Kemp. And Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack saying the rumors spread by conservative media that President Biden plans to stop Americans from eating burgers and steaks to combat climate change is not true. Vilsack telling a meeting of North American agriculture journalists. Sometimes in the political world, games get played and issues are injected into the conversation, knowing full well that there's no factual basis. And China's government is censoring news of Chinese American director Chloe Zhao's win in the Best Director category at Sunday night's Academy Awards ceremony. No reason given for the censorship, but Zhao has criticized the government in Beijing in the past. Ahead of President Biden's reaching 100 days in office, several news organizations putting out polls on his job approval. A Fox News poll, for instance, finding 54% majority of voters approve of President Biden's job performance. That's lower than former President Barack Obama's 62% and George W. Bush's 63% at this point, but higher than former President Donald Trump, who had 45%. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham telling Fox News Sunday he's not been impressed so far.
Well, during the campaign, he made us all believe that Joe Biden would be the moderate choice, that he really, that court packing was a bonehead idea. All of a sudden, we got a commission to change the structure of the Supreme Court, making D.C. a state. I think that's a very radical idea that will change the makeup of the United States Senate. AOC said his first 100 days exceeded her expectations. That's all you need to know. I like Joe Biden, but I'm in the 43%. He's been a disaster on foreign policy. The border is in chaos. The Iranians are off the mat. He's opening up negotiations with the Iranian regime, and they haven't done a damn thing to change. Afghanistan's going to fall apart. Russia and China are already pushing him around. So I'm very worried. I think he's been a very destabilizing president. And economically, he's throwing a wet blanket over the recovery, wanting to raise taxes in a large amount and regulate America basically out of business. So I'm not very impressed with the first 100 days. This is not what I thought I would get from Joe Biden.
Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox News Sunday, one of the five Sunday TV talk shows replayed each Sunday here on C-SPAN Radio. The senator mentioning the U.S.-Mexico border, and today Vice President Kamala Harris, who has been put in charge of the border situation by President Biden, met with the president of Guatemala in the ceremonial office in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, part of the White House complex.
When we last spoke by telephone a few weeks ago, we discussed our shared commitment to expanding opportunities in Guatemala and throughout the region. And as you, of course, know, the people of Guatemala have been suffering greatly because of the recent hurricanes, the persistent drought, and, of course, the damage from COVID-19. And as we have discussed, these are the acute factors that in many ways are causing people to leave their homes despite the fact that they would probably prefer to stay. There are also longstanding issues that are often called the root causes of immigration. We are looking at the issue of poverty and the lack, therefore, of economic opportunities, the issue of extreme weather conditions and the lack of climate adaptation, as well as corruption and the lack of good governance, and violence against women, indigenous people, LGBTQ people, and Afro-descendants. And we want to work with you to address both the acute causes as well as the root causes in a way that will bring hope to the people of Guatemala that there will be an opportunity for them if they stay at home. Part of the spirit behind our work is that, of course, the Western Hemisphere is our collective home, and the people in it and our neighbors, including the people of Guatemala, are nearby, and we have a responsibility, therefore, to engage. The United States plans to increase relief to the region, strengthen our cooperation to manage migration in an effective, secure, and humane manner. And in addition to our bilateral work and our multilateral efforts, the United States is building a comprehensive strategy with international institutions, with allies around the globe, with foundations here in the United States, and the private sector, as well as community organizations. In addition, tomorrow I will meet with Guatemalan community leaders, and I'm eager to hear their thoughts. The people of the region, of course, must be at the center of everything we do. I believe that the work, in order to be successful, will require everyone's participation, and I do believe also it will require political will and hard work to accomplish our goals, but I am confident that we can make progress and create a sense of hope for the future. And Mr. President, again, I'm honored to meet with you. I look forward to traveling to Guatemala and meeting with you in person. And currently, our plan is to come there in the month of June. Thank you.
Muchas gracias.
Vice President Kamala Harris meeting with the President of Guatemala in Washington. She also plans in June to visit the other Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador and Honduras. A story at the Hill newspaper, House Republican Conference Chair Liz Cheney broke Monday with House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, telling reporters that a proposed 9/11-style independent commission should narrowly focus on the deadly January 6th attack on the Capitol. McCarthy, a close ally of former President Trump, has said the scope of the bipartisan commission should be broader and include other episodes of political violence like Black Lives Matter and Antifa protests around the country that have turned violent at times. We'll hear from Congresswoman Cheney in a moment. First, here is Congressman McCarthy on Fox News Sunday.
You've had political violence for the last year in this building. You had a Good Friday, an officer killed for a political belief right on that Capitol as well. If you're now going to put a commission together, why wouldn't you look at all the problems?
So will you want to agree to a commission unless it has that broader scope?
I'm the one who asked for a commission. It's Speaker Pelosi who's been trying to make it partisan.
But I'm asking, would you accept a commission that's focused on the riot at the Capitol?
This is too important to negotiate in the press and not sit down with the other leaders and walk through to solve this problem for the American public.
House Republican Leader Kevin McCarthy on Fox News Sunday. Now, Congressman Liz Cheney, number three in the House Republican leadership at a House Republican Issues Conference being held in Orlando, Florida. First question is whether former President Donald Trump should be prosecuted for the attack on the Capitol January 6th, and then a follow-up on the potential scope of that congressional commission to look into it.
Well, that's a decision that the Justice Department is going to have to make. I stand by my statement. There are ongoing criminal investigations, and those will play out. I do think it's really important that we have a commission. I think that, you know, it's been too long. Whether you look at the Speaker's initial proposal, which was very clearly partisan, you know, that delayed us. It shouldn't have. We need, if you look at what happened after Pearl Harbor, if you look at what happened after the Kennedy assassination, if you look at what happened after 9/11, we established a bipartisan commission. And it ought to be a commission, in my view, that is the members of the commission should be retired. They shouldn't be currently serving officials that, face political pressure of any kind. It should be absolutely bipartisan in nature. And it should begin immediately. It should have subpoena power, and it should begin immediately because the American people need to know how we got to January 6th, what happened on January 6th, and people need to be held accountable.
Kevin McCarthy said yesterday that he would like for that commission to have a broader focus on all recent political violence. What is your view? Should that commission be focused on a full accounting of January 6th specifically?
I think that what happened on January 6th is unprecedented in our history. And I think that, it's very important that the commission be able to focus on that. I'm very concerned, as all my colleagues are, about the violence that we saw, the BLM, the Antifa violence last summer. I think that's a different set of issues, a different set of problems, and a different set of solutions. And so I think it's very important that the January 6th commission focus on what happened on January 6th and what led to that attack.
The House Republican Conference Chair Liz Cheney, who was one of 10 House Republicans to vote to impeach former President Trump after that January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, she spoke today at a House Republican Issues Conference, a retreat in Orlando, Florida. The U.S. Capitol Police saying today they arrested a Virginia man on Sunday evening who climbed over the perimeter fencing of the Capitol grounds. They've identified him as 22-year-old Mark Beauchamp of Enrico, Virginia. He's charged with unlawful entry. Cap Police said that while the investigation is ongoing, they believe this was an isolated incident. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi administering the oath of office today to the new House Sergeant-at-Arms. It's Major General William Walker, former commander of the D.C. National Guard, who on January 6 pleaded with the Pentagon for permission to send Guard troops to help defend the Capitol, request that did drag on for hours. Here is today's swearing-in on the House floor with Speaker Pelosi.
The chair will now administer the oath to the Sergeant-at-Arms designate William Joseph Walker. Will Mr. Walker please present himself in the well? General Walker, do you solemnly swear or affirm that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you are about to enter, so help you God. Congratulations.
William Walker is the 38th House Sergeant-at-Arms. He's also the first black person to serve as the House top law enforcement officer. And the previous Sergeant-at-Arms, both in the House and the Senate, resigned after the attack on the Capitol January 6th. And William Walker, as Sergeant-at-Arms, will be the one who announces the arrival of President Biden on Wednesday for that first speech to a joint session of Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court has accepted a case that deals with the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, the first such type case to come before the high court since 2010. We spoke about it with Daniel Lippman, who covers the White House and Washington for Politico.
So this case is about a New York state law that, you know, made it very difficult to kind of hold a weapon, concealed carry. This is all about that, and it kind of imposed limits. You had to kind of prove why you needed to, have such a permit, and require these types of permits. And the importance of this case is that we haven't really seen a gun control case since Amy Coney Barrett took office in the court in October. She was the last of three Trump appointees, and so that might mean that it's going to be much harder for states going forward to regulate gun control.
Do we know why they accepted the case? Is it, can we speculate that it's because the new justices are swaying that way?
That's what court watchers are saying, that they're trying to kind of put a conservative imprint on the court on this type of issue. Anytime the way the process works is that Supreme Court justices usually vote on whether to accept the case or not. And so previously, before, the last Trump appointee was put on the court, the vote might have failed. And so I think they're kind of testing the case law and to see if this is something that they want to weigh in on. And, you know, the public pressures, they don't feel that as much because, it's kind of the Supreme Court, you get a lifelong tenure. And so you can kind of buck public opinion, because if you look at public opinion polls, the majority of Americans are outraged by these types of massacres. And so they are kind of in support of some at least modest restrictions, added restrictions on guns in this country. But the Supreme Court does not kind of look at the polls usually of this type of stuff.
The case is going to be heard the next term. So how far away will a decision be?
So right now we're at the end of April. They haven't really released the schedule of what, when this case is going to be heard. But the new session starts early October. And usually these types of rulings are issued either, usually in the spring of the following session, since it takes a while for them to write them. And for it all kind of to be buttoned up, and they often leave the most controversial decisions to the end of the term. And so for this term, we're looking at opinions that, come out at the end of June.
Given what this case is about, how far-reaching could a decision be?
So unclear right now, since they didn't really say, they only kind of had a one sentence, one phrase, about this case. And so they're not going to tip their hand as to how it would affect, broader gun control legislation. But it could have widespread ramifications if they strike down the case and would make it much harder for concealed carry, permits to be required for some of these types of guns. And so there's a lot of gun control advocates who are nervous that the composite of the court, the makeup of the court, is not favorable to them. It doesn't seem like there's much action on the federal level either. And so I think Congress would be thinking about how to craft any legislation they do to pass, strong constitutional muster in the Supreme Court.
And yeah, as you mentioned, this is all coming as President Biden and congressional Democrats looking to enact stricter federal gun control laws. Any reaction from them to the Supreme Court taking this case?
Pretty early, because senators don't usually want to weigh in before the court has ruled. They don't want to be seen as interfering in the Supreme Court. But Democrats privately, I'm sure, are nervous that this could make their jobs harder. This is why the Supreme Court seats are so severely contested, because both parties know that there's huge stakes involved, and that their policy, you can win Congress, you can win the White House, but you could have stuff struck down by the court if you can't, if you have holes in the legislation or you don't cross all your T's and dot your I's. For this type of matter, these types of matters.
Daniel Lipman covers White House and Washington for Politico. Read his articles at politico.com and follow him on Twitter at @DLipman. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks for being with us today on Washington Today. Download the free C-SPAN radio app to listen not only to C-SPAN radio, but the three C-SPAN TV networks, and get this program as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts. I hope you have a very good evening.